Welcome to episode 202 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for the week of February 25th, 2013. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In this week's episode of the Fredcast, how North American roads may contribute to a greater injury risk for cyclists here rather than in Europe. San Francisco cabs are getting passenger mirrors to help prevent doorings. Ram announcing a race that you and I can actually complete. Some product recall, some pro racing news, and have you heard the one about the horse who walked into a bike shop? Following the news, a great interview with Jason Gay, sports reporter for the Wall Street Journal. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Hello, Freds. Welcome back to another episode of the Fredcast. Great to be back here with you. I don't know what it's like in your neck of the woods, but it's still really cold here. But I know spring is coming, so it's time to get back into the rhythm and the swing of doing more Fredcasts. But first, let's talk about our friends at Jensen USA. Now, I've been giving you this URL for a long time, jensenusa.com/thefredcast. And for a long time, that's just sort of taken you to generalized specials that Jensen USA will have going on from time to time. As an example, this week they've got a huge clothing clearance going on, and we're in the final week of that. But now, if you go to jensenusa.com/thefredcast, what you're going to get are my personal picks from their huge inventory of items. On a regular basis, I'll be going through their list of items, which I've told you is really quite extensive, and giving you some items that I've picked out that I think are either really great products, really great prices, or both. And there's some great products in there now. I don't want to tease it. Go check it out. It's jensenusa.com/thefredcast. Go there. If there's something you really like on the list, that's great. I've picked out some really great deals there of everything from apparel to components to accessories and even complete bikes. But if there's not, you're already at Jensen USA, where you know you're going to find a great selection, some of the best prices around, and incomparable customer service. So as always, you can go through the Fredcast.com and click the JensenUSA.com link on the right-hand side of the page. But go to jensenusa.com/thefredcast to see my personal picks from Jensen's inventory. And by the way, when you click that link, they know that you got to Jensen USA through the Fredcast, and that's a good thing for the show. So to support the show, make sure you always use one of our links, jensenusa.com/thefredcast, or click the Jensen USA link on the right-hand side of the page. As always, we thank Jensen USA for their support of the Fredcast, and we thank you for your support of Jensen USA. Topping the Fredcast news this week is a study out of Canada that I personally found very interesting, and I think you will as well. You know, we look at a lot of studies when we talk about cycling, whether it's about, oh man, I mean, everything in the world, from whether or not helmets hurt or help, what your saddle height and your handlebar height should be, whether or not kids should be riding to school, and this and that, and a lot of studies when it comes to safety. This is a new study that comes out of Canada's Ryerson University from their School of Occupational and Public Health. And here they weren't looking necessarily at helmets or the kind of cycling that you're doing. What they were looking at specifically was how road infrastructure, or the lack thereof, affects safety of cyclists on the road. And the bottom line results of the study were that cyclists here in North America are between 8 and 30 times more likely to have a serious injury while cycling on public roads than cyclists in Europe. And specifically, they looked at Germany, Denmark, and Holland. Now, immediately as I thought about that, I realized, of course, well, Denmark and Holland are two countries with some of the best cycling infrastructure in the world. I've been to both places, I've cycled in both places, and there's no doubt that not only is the infrastructure really good there, but the attitude toward people riding a bicycle on the streets is quite different than what I've seen, at least here in the United States and Canada, where I have ridden my bike. I haven't ridden in Mexico, so I can't speak to that. But for North America, I've ridden in the United States and Canada, and I can tell you that the attitudes and the infrastructure is quite different. And what I find really interesting is that they looked at Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands. They didn't look at places like Italy, France, the UK, and other places where cycling infrastructure isn't quite as good as it is in those other countries that I mentioned. So you may look at it and say it's skewed. Another way to look at it, however, is it's maybe the best versus, I can't say we're the worst, but the not so best, if you will. Okay, some major findings that they found in this study. Examples. And just to be clear now, I want you to know that I'm reading straight from a story at this point because they've encapsulated the findings quite well. So for instance, where do you find safer intersections? Okay, those are intersections on residential streets, makes sense, and intersections where cars are traveling under 30 kilometers per hour. By traveling less than 30 km, that decreases the risk of injuring a cyclist by half. So if you're starting to think about roads that you want to ride on, these are some really good tips for you. All right, some intersections that are less safe. Again, I think this goes without saying, traffic circles. In the study, 19 of 690 accidents occurred in Vancouver intersections with traffic circles. Okay, so even though traffic circles are meant as what's called a quote-unquote traffic calming measure, they can actually increase the risk of cycling injuries. Intersections that have a grade. Roads that slope downhill are more dangerous than roads that slope uphill. And arriving at an intersection in the opposite direction of vehicular traffic is also less safe. Again, think that goes without saying. Okay, non-intersections. Where is it safer? Separated bike lanes along major streets. Bike routes with traffic diversion on local streets. And bike-only paths separated from traffic. Again, makes sense, but I think that, again, here in the United States, and certainly in Canada as well, we're going to be finding that, yes, where there's bike lanes, we're not going to be able to find those separated bike lanes. All right, non-intersections that are less safe, streetcar tracks, downhill grades, construction sites, and shared bike lanes or single bike lanes with parked cars present. Again, that ever-present dooring hazard that can occur to cyclists. Okay, one of the more controversial findings in the study, and I've tried to avoid this, for instance, on the Spokesman podcast, because it's like talking to people about fashion or music or whether they wear helmets or not. But the researchers specifically found that painted and shared bike lanes that you can commonly find in all kinds of major metropolitan areas in the US and Canada offered, quoting now, no significant protection for cyclists. So think about that for a moment. As a matter of fact, if you're listening to the Enhanced podcast, you're going to see that that's exactly what the graphic is that accompanies this story, is a painted shared bike lane offering no significant protection for cyclists. So a lot of you, and I know I do this myself, we'll choose our routes, especially for commuting, based upon where we can find a bike lane. Under this, at least according to the study, false impression that painted bike lane offers us some measure of protection. According to this study, no significant protection for cyclists. According to one of the authors of the study, quote, our research demonstrates that transportation planners really need to segregate cyclists from motor vehicle traffic, just as we use sidewalks to separate pedestrians. If people see cycling as a safer activity, they would be more encouraged to commute by bike, which makes them more active and healthy citizens. Now, this is exactly what I have seen in Holland and in Denmark, and I'm racking my brain trying to remember a place in Germany where I may have seen this, but certainly in Holland and in Denmark, I've seen exactly this, separated bike lanes. You'll have a pedestrian walkway, you'll have a separated bike lane, and then you will have traffic on the street. And this research is indicating that that is what makes cyclists, especially in major cities, most safe. Now, the methodology of how they went about doing this study, they did a lot of interviews between May 2008 and November 2009, interviewing 690 cyclists who specifically were injured in Toronto and in Vancouver. All of the cyclists in the study went to the emergency room when they had their injuries, and their injuries ranged from minor injuries to serious injuries. Of those, 211 were injured at intersections and 479 injured along roads and paths. And the researchers specifically looked at where on the route each of the cyclists were injured, and then they asked them to describe their injury and their trip. And then they visited several randomly selected locations along each route that would coincide with the specific injury site. They gathered the details about what was present, what wasn't present, what the physical characteristics were of the roadway or the intersection, and then they performed statistical analysis in order to look at the relationships between safety and whatever infrastructure there was in place on the roadway. I read the complete study. I found it very compelling and very, very interesting. It reminded me, and I'm trying to look for it on my bookcase up there, of Tom Vanderbilt's book, Traffic, just in the way that they looked at the particular problem. So I've got a link in the show notes to the full study. It's a link to a PDF file. So just realize when you click it, it's going to open up a PDF on your computer. You'll find it very compelling as well. Love to hear your thoughts on it. But I think that it's going to stir up a bit of a hornet's nest, especially about the difference between painted and separated bike lanes. Go ahead and check it out for yourself. You may remember a few Fredcasts ago when I brought you the story of Dirk Friel and his riding buddy who were out riding near Boulder, Colorado recently, and were, well, at least according to the video evidence, it looked like they were being harassed by a driver in an SUV. You'll remember I played the video showing them riding right of the white line on the side of the road while this individual in the SUV just laid on his horn nonstop while they were out riding. Well, the vehicle was traced by the Colorado State Patrol through its license plate to a Mr. James Ernst of Erie, Colorado. Mr. Ernst, in his 70s, went before a judge and pled guilty to charges of harassment and illegal use of a horn. And last week, Mr. Ernst was sentenced to 12 months of probation, 20 hours of community service, and anger management and traffic courses. Now, in going in front of the judge in Colorado, Mr. Ernst said prior to his sentencing, quote, "The road is a double yellow line, uphill for a long ways, and it's very narrow. With no paved shoulder, it's really not safe for bicyclists." Well, Judge Noel Blum told Ernst in the sentencing that it really doesn't matter, that none of that really matters, saying, quote, "The issue isn't whether the bicyclist could have taken other action or not. If they're riding where they're supposed to be, you have to be patient and certainly can't be leaning on your horn," unquote. So Mr. Ernst gets his sentence. Hopefully we'll get some anger management. Unfortunately, ever since this video, which by the way, as of this recording, has nearly 500,000 views, ever since the airing of that video, Mr. Ernst says that he's received threatening phone calls and mail, which drives me crazy, right? I mean, here we are showing what you're not supposed to do as a motorist and responding to it with what you're not supposed to do as a human. That just, it just drives me crazy. Anyway, glad to hear that this case had a positive result, and thankfully nobody was injured in what was at least some kind of an altercation. Well, continuing what seems to be a safety theme tonight is a story that I found through our friend Fritz and the Cyclicious blog, and he found this on the Mission website. It's a San Francisco-specific website. It appears that some of the city's newer taxi cabs in the city by the bay are going to be getting mirrors that will be used by passengers before they exit the taxi to ensure that they look out for pedestrians and cyclists, specifically to help prevent cyclist doorings. I think it's an amazing idea and one that we hope, at least I hope, we'll be able to see in other major cities. Later on tonight, you're going to hear my interview with Jason Gay from the Wall Street Journal, and we talked a little bit about cycling in New York City. Could you imagine if every New York City taxi cab had a mirror like these that are going in the newer taxi cabs in San Francisco? I just think it would be awesome. So look for those. Hey, you know, and if you see one in the wild, if you're out in San Francisco and you see a taxi cab that has one of these mirrors, do me a favor, snap a picture of it, send it my way. I'll put it up on the website. I think it's just a great idea. So look for anti-doring mirrors coming to a taxi cab near you. I don't know how many of you have seen Stephen Auerbach's movie Bicycle Dreams, or perhaps how many of you have seen the ads appearing on your Facebook feed. You'll recall that I reviewed Bicycle Dreams here on the Fredcast, oh, probably over a year ago. And if you're like me, an event like the Race Across America, or RAM, is one that is really intriguing. I remember when I thought riding 100 miles was just crazy. Or riding 120 miles, a double metric, was, you know, just, you got to be insane to do something like that. Or riding a double century, 200 miles, was, you know, you'd had to be committed to do something like that. Now they're commonplace. But there's one event that I know I'll never have the opportunity to do, and yet which intrigues me perhaps like no other, and that is the Race Across America, the race that begins on the West Coast and ends up on the East Coast, and it is a nonstop odyssey for the racers and their crews as they go through weather, riding in the cold and in the heat, night and day, just incredible. I'll never have the opportunity to ride RAM. And that's why what it intrigued me when I read about RAM announcing what they are now calling the RAM Challenge. The RAM Challenge will be a series of recreational rides that are going to take place in a variety of different locations across the United States in 2013, beginning on March the 9th, coming up really quickly, in Austin, Texas. Now, the way the RAM Challenge events are going to work is they're going to be just like a lot of the recreational rides that many of us already participate in. They're going to have 30, 60, and 120-mile events, and those are approximate because they may vary depending on location. And then there's going to be two, what they're calling endurance rides, of a 200-mile double century and a 400-mile event. You can ride these, at least the 200, randonneur style, unsupported, or with a support crew. And the 120-mile ride is going to be very, very similar to a Grand Fondo in that it will be a timed event. It sounds like just a lot of fun for those of us who are recreational riders, but each event also includes an opportunity for solo and relay racers to qualify for the Race Across America, which will begin on June the 11th in Oceanside, California. So for those of you who might be interested, of course, I've got a link in the show notes to the RAM Challenge, but the dates and locations for 2013 are as follows. March 9th, near Austin, Texas. April the 6th, Oceanside, California. May 11th, in Portland, Oregon. August 17th, in Minneapolis. September 14th, in Sacramento. September 28th, in Columbus, Ohio, and November 2nd in Daytona Beach, Florida. It's the RAM Challenge. Sounds like a lot of fun. Go ahead and check it out. Well, let's move away from safety and talk about a couple of products, starting first with a product that was recently announced and is now available that I find, well, intriguing. It's the Reflect. And by the way, that's sort of an interesting internet-y kind of spelling, R-F-L-K-T, and the Reflect is from Wahoo Fitness. Now, you may recall, we met Wahoo Fitness a couple of years ago at press camp when they were touting the Wahoo bike case for your iPhone. Well, Wahoo has kind of taken an interesting turn, and now what they've got in the Reflect is a bike computer that mounts on your handlebars like any other, but which literally reflects the data that's being collected and displayed on your iPhone by your favorite cycling application. So imagine, as an example, you want to use the Cyclemeter app, or maybe you want to use the Strava app. but you don't want to mount your iPhone on your handlebars. You just want to keep it safely tucked away in your jersey pocket. The Reflect pairs with your iPhone using Bluetooth and literally reflects the data that's being displayed on your phone using your favorite bike computer app right there on the Reflect computer on your handlebars. The Reflect also allows you to control your music. If you're listening to your iPhone using headphones, you'll be able to pause, play, skip, etc., all through the controls on the Reflect cycle computer on your handlebars. It will also allow you to build multiple screens on the Reflect that would, again, show you the data that is on your iPhone. Now, right now, it's compatible with the brand new version of Wahoo Fitness's own iPhone app. It's version 3.0, but Wahoo is promising that Strava and Cycle Meter are coming soon with additional apps yet to come. I think it's a really intriguing idea for a bike computer, allowing the brains to be in your smartphone, but having a specific bike computer that then reflects what's displayed. And by the way, that includes your GPS data as well. Wahoo Fitness says that the suggested retail for the Reflect is $129. And yes, of course, I have links in the show notes. I'm curious to check this one out. If you get a chance to, I'd love to get your review right here on the show. Well, speaking of products, and you knew this was coming because it's been a while since I've done these, I wanted to bring your attention to a couple of product recalls. I've got three of them tonight, so just bear with me. I'll roll through them quickly, but I want to let you know about them. The first recall, it's not a huge one, just 90 of these. They are 2011 Norco Havoc, H-A-V-O-C, bicycles. The problem here is that the bike frame could crack at the joint where the top tube and down tube meet, and you can imagine what that might mean for you if you're actually riding one of these bikes. And Norco apparently has received three reports of cracked frames. Now, the recall involves 2011 Havoc 24 and 26 inch bicycles. The 24 inch bikes were sold in a semi matte gray and the 26 inch in a semi matte red. There's more details on the recall page and the links are in the show notes. Most importantly, as always, if you've got one of these bikes, please stop riding it. Follow the instructions in the recall notice to contact Norco so that it can be returned to your authorized Norco dealer for a replacement. All right, the second recall, there's about 200 of these. These are from Wheelier Bikes, and these are the Izoard XP bikes from Wheelier Triestina, USA of Atlanta, Georgia. And in this case, it's the fork steerer tube that can break while you are riding the bike. And again, you can imagine what that would do. These are the Wheelier Triestina model Izoard XP bikes or frame sets that were sold with carbon alloy. I don't know why I had a problem with that one. Carbon alloy forks with serial numbers between LH0001 and LH4000. And you can find the serial number on the steerer tube of the fork about 6 inches from the crown. Look, if you have a Wheelier Izoard bike, you're not going to take it apart to look for the serial number. Take it to your dealer and have them check it out and see if it's covered by the recall. Again, the recall notice is in the show notes. And finally, a much larger recall. So listen up if you are the owner of a Specialized road bike from 2012 or 2013, because there's about 12,200 of these that are being recalled, specifically the 2012 Tarmac SL4, 2013 Tarmac SL4, 2013 Crux, and 2013 Sec Tour Disc. Once again, it's a steer tube problem in the front fork. Steer tube could break and cause a fall hazard. And Specialized has received two incidents reported, one with a fall with facial injuries and lacerations that required stitches. As always, with any of these recalls, if you even suspect that your bike or your bike parts might be covered by one of these recalls, stop using it immediately. Consult the show notes where I've got links to each of the recall notices from the Consumer Product Safety Commission and get to your local dealer to have it checked out. These things are not to be messed with. It's a big deal to recall a product, and therefore it's very important that you get it taken care of. And from products, let's turn to professional racing. But before we start, Just a couple of things. Number one, brief professional racing. We're really at the very beginning of the season. And to be honest, I know many of us are pretty tired of pro racing at the moment anyway. Second of all, I want to let you know, if you're looking for news on the latest on what's going on with Lance Armstrong this week, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but you're not going to find it here. If you'd like to find out a little bit more about what's going on in the Armstrong situation, as if you don't know enough already, or you haven't heard it through the mainstream media enough already, we talked about it for about 25 minutes on The Spokesman the other day. So go ahead and check out The Spokesman podcast at www.the-spokesman.com. Now, you may remember on a recent episode of the Fredcast, I talked about the fact that the UCI had signed a memorandum of understanding with Omega Pharma Quickstep owner Zdenek Bakala and his business partner Bessel Koch to reform the professional cycling calendar and to bring in what was being termed as the World Series of Cycling. Talked about it a couple of shows ago. Well, VeloNews had the opportunity to catch up with Pat McQuaid at the recent UCI Cyclocross World Championships that took place over Super Bowl weekend in Louisville, Kentucky, here in the United States. And in that interview, McQuaid told VeloNews that the idea of reforming the racing calendar and to do the World Series of Cycling, that idea had been shelved, quote unquote. In a specific quote to VeloNews, McQuaid is quoted as saying, quote, "The sport of cycling needs to be professionalized. It needs to be much more professional. We're in competition with other sports for television airtime. We need to look at our professional sport today and modernize it, so to speak, without losing its traditional values. What has been proposed, about 10 four-day races, a bit like Formula One, is not the way to do it. The UCI has been in discussion with the investors who are going to invest in the World Series of Cycling and have now decided not to invest in the World Series of Cycling and to work with the UCI to develop this project with the UCI. The UCI retains the majority of the board of the company that is going to do this," unquote. All right. I read through that about 50 times, and each time there was a couple of things that struck me. Number one, it says nothing. And number two, isn't professional cycling already professional? I mean, why is it that in just a few sentences, McQuaid has to say the word professional several times? Or is this some sort of a hint of something that's to come? Or is it some sort of a way to say that over the last few years, considering all of the revelations that have come about in the last few months, that professional cycling wasn't, quote unquote, professionalized, his words, and now he is going to make it more professional? I don't know. It just struck me as strange. Bottom line is, nothing really is changing with the racing calendar in the foreseeable future. Having said all that, it is interesting to note that the World Tour has begun for 2013 with just one event completed now. Of course, it's the Santos Tour Down Under, which took place in January. So as of January 27th, TJ Tom Jelte-Slachter from the Netherlands is in first position in the World Tour rankings, followed by Javier Moreno-Bazan, Geraint Thomas, John Izaguirre in Sausti, Ben Hermans, Wilco Kelderman, Gorka Izaguirre in Sausti, Daniela Pietropoli, Andre Greipel, and Thiago Machado. Now, there are a number of World Tour races coming up in March, some of the classics of the calendar, beginning March 3rd through the 10th with Paris-Nice, followed the 6th through the 12th with Tirreno-Adriatico. On the 17th, it's the one-day Milan-San Remo. The 18th through the 24th is the Volta Ciclista al Catalunya. March 22nd, the E3 Harelbeke race. March 24th, Gent-Wevelgem. And March 31st, the Ronde van Vlaanderen, the Tour of Flanders. Those are your World Tour races for March. We're going to see big changes in the World Tour rankings. After that, we'll bring you as many results as we can right here on the Fredcast. And of course, by the way, links to each of the websites for each of those races are in this week's show notes. And lastly, in the news tonight, you've heard the one about the bull in the china shop, and you've probably heard the one about the horse that walks into a bar, but have you heard the one about the horse that walked into a bike shop? This one, no laughing matter. A horse walked into a bicycle shop on Sunday last week in Bassett, California, near Pasadena. and about 45 bicycles were damaged and about $4,000 in damage done to the store. Apparently, the horse broke free from a nearby equestrian community and ran amok inside Reyes Bicycle Shop on Valley Boulevard in Bassett, according to Los Angeles County Sheriff's officials. The horse suffered cuts and ultimately became trapped in bicycles, according to the shopkeeper's 14-year-old son. Jesse Ruben Reyes said, quote, "There's a gang of damage on the bikes, but nobody got really hurt." Now, after the horse made its way into the store, it started, according to Jesse, hitting all the bikes and started getting stuck. "I was scared. I was panicking." Now, there were about two or three customers in the store at the time, and they fled out the back door, while one sought refuge in the bathroom. Eventually, the horse did find a way to thrash its way free of the bikes and exit the store on its own. Deputies and animal control officers responded and helped with the situation. The horse owner and the shopkeeper did meet to discuss payment for the damage. Thankfully, other than a few cuts, the horse was relatively uninjured, and also thankfully for Reyes, the shop reopened for business as usual just a day later. Well, that's going to do it for the news on this week's episode of the Fredcast. Coming up next, a great interview with Jason Gay from the Wall Street Journal. But first, I just wanted to give a mention to our next sponsor, EpicPlanet.tv. We've talked about the Epic Rides DVDs before. Beautiful scenery, some of the most amazing cycling scenery around the United States, vividly captured on DVD. And it allows you to do an indoor workout using a beautiful digital dashboard and your indoor trainer. And for me, I've been using it in conjunction with Trainer Road. You may remember that we interviewed Nate from Trainer Road a few shows ago. And what I really like about the combination of the two is I've got the resistance and dashboard of Trainer Road. So it's controlling my CompuTrainer for me while I'm watching the great scenery and riding all over the country. I come upstairs from the basement and everybody in my family wants to know, where did you ride today? Even though I was just in the basement. So whether I was riding in Maine or Arizona or in Minnesota and Wisconsin, literally all over the country, simply through being able to use the Epic Rides DVDs. And Epic Planet has a great deal for Fredcast listeners. Fredcast listeners get a special discount of 20% on all DVDs and digital downloads, combos, and bundles. All you have to do is when you check out, use the discount code Fred. So go ahead and click through the link in the Enhanced Podcast right now. Click the link in our show notes or click the link right on the homepage at www.thefredcast.com. And when you check out, make sure you use that discount code Fred to get your 20% off Fredcast discount. Thanks so much for Epic Planet for supporting the Fredcast, and thank you for supporting Epic Planet. Well, just before this year's Super Bowl here in the United States, a strange article, kind of out of place, appeared in the Wall Street Journal, written by a gentleman by the name of Jason Gay. And the article was about, of all things, with the Super Bowl coming up, the 2013 UCI World Cyclocross Championships taking place in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, I've been a reader of Jason Gay's for a long time, and I wasn't surprised that he was writing about cyclocross, but to be honest with you, I was a bit surprised that it took place in the Wall Street Journal just before the Super Bowl. And for the last couple of weeks, Jason and I have been emailing each other back and forth, trying to get a chance when we might be able to get on the phone and chat for the Fredcast, because I find it intriguing and delightful and pleasantly surprising to find mainstream traditional media like the Wall Street Journal devoting valuable page space, real estate, in their publication on a regular basis to topics related to cycling and not just related to Lance Armstrong. So tonight, I finally had a chance to catch up with Jason. We had a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed doing the interview. I hope that you'll enjoy listening to it. So here's my interview from earlier this evening with Jason Gay from the Wall Street Journal. Well, it is my pleasure to welcome to the Fredcast, Jason Gay. Jason is a writer for the Wall Street Journal, but you may have also read some of his stuff in places like GQ and Rolling Stone and Outside Magazine and lots of other places. Jason, welcome to the Fredcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. I guess I want to start a little bit with, you know, for people maybe who aren't familiar with you, I read your stuff in the Wall Street Journal all the time, but give everybody a little bit of info on your background. How did you get into journalism and specifically sports?
You know, I started as a sports writer. I actually worked at a very small newspaper in Massachusetts on Martha's Vineyard Island. It was my first job out of college, and you know, started covering like Little League baseball and high school football, and sports there are actually kind of a big thing. You know, it's a small community, especially in the wintertime. And so that was kind of my first brush with sports writing. And then I moved to some papers in Boston and New York, and, you know, always kept an interest in sports. You know, grew up with it. My dad's still a high school tennis coach, and, you know, loved growing up around games and so on. So no matter where I was, whether it was magazines or somewhere else, you know, tried to do a little bit of sports writing here and there. But the journal thing just kind of started as a fluke almost. They were looking for sports columnists, and the section is relatively new. The journal's always had some kinds of sports coverage, but in terms of having a dedicated page, that's only been the last bunch of years. And it was just a real privilege to just be part of it. And you know, they've been really wonderful in terms of giving everyone a good deal of latitude to follow stories that interest them. And cycling is something that I'm passionate about. I got into a few years ago, or more than a few years ago, and obviously there's been a lot going on in the sport professionally, but I also like writing about it from the sort of standpoint of the amateur, the recreational rider, the commuter. You know, I live in New York City. You know, cycling and safe streets and commuting and cycling as a lifestyle is such a huge subject here and such a dynamic and political issue that there's an endless amount to write about with regard to bikes.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's talk about your cycling in particular. What kind of cycling do you enjoy?
Well, it got totally started when I met my wife, which is about 10 years ago. She was a, you know, daredevil cyclist through the streets of New York. And quite honestly, when I met her, I thought she was crazy to just be riding a bike all over New York City. And not only was she riding in the city, but she was going across the George Washington Bridge, one of the big bridges out of the city, into New Jersey, and going on these long, sometimes 100-mile rides. And I just thought it was totally insane that anyone would do this. I thought just getting on a bike alone in New York was taking your life into your own hands. But, you know, I did it for love. You know, I just kind of got riding and wanted to be around her, and got dusted off an old mountain bike I had from years ago. And then, you know, it's the famous story. I just got hopelessly hooked. You know, I loved it, and, you know, migrated from short rides to longer rides, and from longer rides to super long rides, and started doing some racing. And, you know, I never amounted to much of anything as a racer or anything like that, but it's, I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners are, you know, it's just, you just get addicted to it. It's just the whole world and the whole subculture of people and characters and fun. And boy, you just spend so much time and energy obsessing about it. And I you know, I haven't raced competitively in a little bit, and I have to admit, I miss it a good deal, even though I was never any good at it.
You know, it's funny. If you look at Jason's bio at WSJ.com, it says specifically that you race a bicycle very, very slowly.
That is an accurate statement.
Many of us do. So, you know, that's just the way it is. When I used to race,
you know, if I could just hang on, you know, if I could just, like, you know, stay in the slipstream and yep, finish with the group, I was happy. Let's put it that way.
Hey, listen, I used to race downhill mountain bikes, and I did that very, very slowly. So that takes talent.
Yeah, right. No,
sometimes at 0 miles an hour, quite suddenly. So, you know, speaking of racing and cycling enthusiasts, you really, and I don't know, I'm curious to hear what your editors thought. You kind of went, what a lot of us thought was, out on a limb recently. So here we are leading up to the Super Bowl, and you, instead of writing about the Super Bowl, you write about the UCI Cyclocross World Championships. And I'm curious to know what your editors thought. They must have thought you were crazy, but to bring cyclocross to an audience who, for many of them, this is probably the first time they've been exposed to it. What was the reaction in general?
I have to tell you that it was like one of the most satisfying experiences I've had doing this column because, as you said, you know, it is sort of a marginal sport when you consider the grand context of what people pay attention to in sports, and especially in Super Bowl week. But the reaction was awesome. I just was so happy that the way that people in the cyclocross community pass it around. These are people who, you know, I'm sure are regular journal readers, were just really happy to see some kind of exposure for the event. But, you know, going back, you know, I rode cyclocross. That was another sport I rode very slowly. Never any good at it, but I loved it. And as everyone who's been around it knows, it's just an unbelievable scene. You know, and I got the chance to do some of the cool races here on the East Coast. My wife went to college in Portland, so I did like Cross Crusade and some of the, you know, races at the Portland and Raceway out that way. And those were really fun. I mean, just the whole thing is great. I mean, you don't have to tell someone who's been to a cross race how great a cross race is. But I just felt like it's an inherently interesting story that here with this national or international world championships here happening in the United States. And I noticed immediately when it was announced that it was conflicting with the Super Bowl. And I can't tell you how much time I spent on orbit trying to figure out how there would be a way for me to go to both, because I knew I had to be professionally obligated to go to the Super Bowl, which I'm psyched to do, of course. You know, I'm not complaining about going to the Super Bowl, but I'm trying to like figure out how I can do both. And I wasn't able to, so I felt pretty regretful about that. But I knew I wanted to write about it. And I knew that, you know, I just felt like it'd be something readers would be interested in. And quite honestly, there was absolutely no editorial resistance at all. I think they knew that I was into it, and I think they knew that I'd be excited about it. And I think, quite honestly, that's one thing that's great about the Journal as a paper. They're kind of, because it's not, you know, a paper of sports record, you know, people aren't coming to us necessarily to find out, you know, what the score was of the game immediately. We can kind of go off and explore things that are a little bit unconventional. So it's a real credit to them that they were open to it. And then it was really cool to have it kind of redeemed by the fact that readers, you know, really pass it around. I mean, we live in this sort of fascinating time for, you know, news media and the way that social media can really distribute a story in a manner in which, you know, it wasn't possible a generation ago. You can almost watch it happen in real time, this story being passed around the internet. And quite honestly, a fair amount of it was, can you believe the Wall Street Journal did something about cyclocross? What is the world coming to? Which was great. You know, I was really happy about that.
Yeah, you know, I get up in the morning and I grab my cup of coffee and I grab my iPad and the Journal's, you know, one of the things that I read every morning. And when I woke up that morning and I saw that in the Journal, I thought, I'm really curious to see what happens with sort of the cycling Twitterati, if you will, just to see where it goes. And I mean, it lit up the internet. People were really, as you said, just really shocked that the Wall Street Journal was talking about cyclocross. But then again, you know, as I said, I've been reading your stuff for several years, and I know that you always return to cycling. And I wonder, so your editors are behind it, but what about the audience, right? I always think of your typical Wall Street Journal reader, and maybe I'm wrong, as, you know, sort of the white polo going to the country club to play tennis or golf or racquetball or squash or something. And I don't necessarily think of them getting, you know, really dirty in cyclocross or as you said, going out and doing a century or a Grand Fondo. Is this now part of the Journal's demographic? Is it really true that you know, cycling is the new golf?
You know, I can't give you a totally 100% knowledgeable answer on that. The only thing, the things I can say are that, you know, the Journal audience consistently surprises me in terms of its range. And, you know, obviously we do think of, like, you know, the classic Wall Street financially interested audience, but it's, you know, it's a global audience. It's an audience of people in all kinds of different professions. You know, it ranges in terms of its age. And one thing that's been a really common thread and kind of an exciting thing for everybody who works in the sports section is that, you know, whenever you touch upon a sport which might not be in that classic spotlight of, you know, say your ESPN Sports Center and your, you know, back pages of your newspapers and the cover of Sports Illustrated and so on, whenever you touch upon whether it's, you know, cycling or swimming or, you know, fencing or, you know, chess or, you know, just sports that are kind of beyond the sort of standard things that we all pay attention to just through osmosis of looking at headlines, there's a huge reaction. And if you were to look at, you know, what are the top 10, 12, 15 sports stories in terms of, you know, social media hits and people distributing it on Facebook and Twitter at the end of the year, you'll be surprised by how many of them are from that category, of from quote-unquote marginal sports. Because everyone knows that if you want to read about football, if you want to read about the NFL, and it's not to say there isn't terrific NFL reporting in the journal, there is, but there's a voluminous number of places to go out and get that kind of information. So, you know, it's there's been real enthusiasm on the part of the people making decisions, the editors at the sports section, for these kinds of stories. I mean, it's really a nice sort of symbiotic situation here where, you know, you have reporters who are excited about these sports and bring them to a broad audience, but also an audience which is eager to read them and move them around.
You know, I think that, at least from my perspective, and we talked about this on our other show, The Spokesman, earlier this week, and we were saying that one of the issues that, that we have, because we're in this hyper-enthusiast environment when it comes to cycling, especially professional cycling, and we have this endemic media, the cycling media, who tend to bat around the same story nonstop. And so I think for a lot of us, when we see it in the mainstream media, our initial reaction is, okay, this is going to be cool because they're going to take an angle that the endemic media probably hasn't taken. I mean, for instance, look, let's say that you are you know, really into dog shows, as an example, the chance that you're going to read an article like the one that you wrote about labs in the journal, you know, in your sort of endemic dog media, is probably not going to happen. And I think that that's why so many of us get excited when we see a paper like the Journal or any other mainstream press cover cycling. I mean, unless it's the Armstrong.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I hope that, you know, people are excited about it. And, you know, I hope to be able to walk that line and, you know, probably do it well sometimes and probably don't do it terribly well other times, that of, you know, coming to a sport like cycling from a position of some knowledge and background in it and being able to make it clear that I do a little bit at least have familiarity with the topic at hand in a way that feels real to a cycling audience. You know, my hope is that someone, I mean, you know, I'm not going to lie, you know, when I'm writing about a bike article, I'm thinking of my bike friends reading it. You know, I'm thinking of them not rolling their eyes over their coffee. You know, I would assume they do roll their eyes. You know, that's inevitable. You can't please all the people all the time. But I hope that it comes with a certain amount of, you know, appreciation and understanding for the sport, because I, you know, I do love it. I think it's, you know, and I don't love it always, but I don't feel like, you know, it's by any means, you know, a perfect sport, as I'm sure we can discuss later. But it is a passion for a great many people. It's a lifestyle. It's beyond just, you know, stage wins and scandals.
Okay, so you opened the door. I'm going to walk into it. this has not been the greatest year when it comes to cycling, at least in the way that a lot of people look at professional cycling. You had Lance Armstrong's dramatic fall from grace, going from "I never doped" to "Yeah, I did," and now I don't want to talk about it, to USADA anymore. Does that have any effect on what you're writing about, the way that you write, or how the Journal is going to cover cycling in the future? Is that even a consideration?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, the particulars of the Armstrong story, the Journal, you know, has been a very aggressive sorts of news on. You know, there are two reporters, Reed Albergati and Vanessa O'Connell, who have broken a great many stories.
I got to interrupt you there, because I think that that's really something significant that people need to know. There's sort of two stories that I pay a lot of attention to, and it seems like the Journal leads on them. Apple, it seems like the Journal always knows what's going to happen at Apple,
sure,
before most other people do. And the Armstrong thing, the Journal really has done an amazing job, and the reporters you just mentioned, in breaking stories before the endemic cycling media and the general media, in general, if you will. And I think that bears repeating.
Oh, I appreciate that, but I, you know, and I think it's totally fair. I think it's, you know, and all credit to Reid Albergati and to Vanessa O'Connell, who, you know, we look back on all this stuff now, and obviously Armstrong has confessed, and there's this sort of just wave of nausea which permeates the whole subject. But at the time that, you know, the Journal was publishing these stories by Reid and by Vanessa, you know, none of this was on the table. And, this is my 100% biased opinion, but I think it represented a degree of journalistic bravery to kind of stick their neck out there as reporters, you know, obviously deeply sourced stories, deeply credible stories, which were ultimately totally proven to be true. And I agree with you, you know, it's sort of, they were breaking stories that were significant, not just, you know, in the context of mainstream media, but in the sport overall. And they continue to do so. I mean, they've been very aggressive on the story throughout the whole process and will continue to do that kind of thing. I'm very proud to be associated with those guys and the stuff that they've done.
And I think bravery is a good word because, true or not, we hear all these stories about people who were reporters who suffered repercussions as a result of speaking what they thought was the truth about Lance Armstrong, people being shunned, losing jobs, all those kinds of things. So I think bravery is a good word to use.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, I'm hopelessly biased here.
Yeah, of course.
You know, but I do feel that, you know, especially now, because it's very easy to sit there and, you know, take a shot at Lance Armstrong now, but, you know, 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, when he was still quite riding high, when he was still a viable rider in the peloton, you know, to be able to, you know, to publish these kinds of stories that they were doing is enormously significant in terms of the way that this story evolved.
Yeah.
I mean, think back to, you know, these emails that were flying around with Floyd Landis at the time. I mean, these were, you know, radioactive things for news organizations to consider because of, you know, Armstrong's history of going after the messenger.
Yeah, no kidding. How does it affect you? I mean, as a reporter and as a fan and enthusiast, how does it affect your outlook on cycling in general and professional cycling in particular?
Sure. I mean, you know, you said something a moment ago, which I want to circle back to, which was about, you know, this being a bad year for cycling. But, you know, let's be honest here. We're looking at a bad decade. You know, we're looking at some pretty grisly stuff going on for a long time. If you look at, you know, the amount of X's that are through, you know, podium finishers in the Tour de France and other significant stage races. These are pretty bleak times, despite some real progress in terms of teams with real anti-doping commitments. And even as all this stuff was happening, you had a sport which was, you know, very insistent upon looking forward and not looking backward. You know, going back, you know, 5-6 years ago, whenever you speak to pro riders, even the ones that were doing the right things, or so we thought, in terms of anti-doping, they just wanted to sort of point that compass north and not at all look back. And I think it obviously cost the sport because it was its refusal to sort of look back and, you know, dig deep and search its own history that kind of led to this terrible undressing that happened in the past year. And so in terms of the way that I want to look at the sport, you know, I want to look at it, this sounds really corny, but from a sort of 360-degree angle, you know, I want to be able to look at the past and the context of the past and look at, you know, the accusations and the confessions and what they sort of factor into in the broader history of cycling. And as many people have pointed out, and I'm sure people on your podcast have talked about, there's a rich and illustrious history of performance enhancing in the history of professional cycling and cycling in general. So there's that. And then there's also the sport which continues. And there are the great many riders who are, you know, riding without performance enhancement, who are doing it the right way. And their stories need to be told. And then, of course, there are friends and, you know, colleagues who are doing it recreationally as amateur racers. And that's not to say that doping doesn't exist at those levels either, but those stories need to be told as well. So, you know, the thing that makes me nutty, and I feel like I can be somewhat of an asset as a columnist on this topic, is that, you know, I hate the idea of cycling being painted with just one abrupt brushstroke of being dismissive and saying, like, oh, you know, Lance Armstrong just poisoned the whole sport, so the sport is totally, you know, down the tubes and not worth paying any attention to, because it's just a disservice to the people who are doing it the right way.
Yeah, it's a good point. And so hopefully the sponsors will hear you, right? Because we hear all these stories about sponsors, to use your word from before, thinking, well, cycling is now radioactive and we just don't want our name attached to it. And I think that one guy, or maybe even, as you said, one era, may not necessarily be representative of the majority of the cyclists and the teams in the pro peloton now. Although, as you said, there are some stories of amateurs being caught for doping as well. I mean, the guys, yeah, the New York, yeah, Gran Fondo and things like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, sure, of course.
So let's circle to a completely different topic. And that is, you live in New York, you're a cyclist, your wife got you into doing, what sounds like longer and longer rides. What are some of your favorite rides in and around New York?
Well, at this point, we're about to have a baby, so just like riding to the supermarket would be like an accomplishment.
Been there, get it, yeah.
the big things that people do riding in New York City, obviously you have two big parks. You have a park in Brooklyn, Prospect Park, which is what I live near, and there's a group that you can always jump in with riding around loops in Prospect Park. Then you have Central Park, which I go to less frequently, but is equally fantastic, and you can do loops in Central Park. And both Prospect and Central have race series, which run early in the morning. You wake up at the crack of dawn. I mean, not kidding. I mean, they're 5:30 a.m. start times for some of these races. Just brutal. If you want to do a long ride, there are some different kinds of iterations, but the classic one is people ride all the way up the west side of Manhattan. They go over the George Washington Bridge into New Jersey, and they ride either what's called River Road or 9W, and you can go as far as you possibly dream. You can, put on a, 150-mile day if you want to. You can go all the way up to Bear Mountain, go all around to Rockland County, and do all these kind of climbing and things like that. And I did some of that. I did a good deal of it when I really was excited. But the more I rode, I focused a little bit more, on sort of intensity training and, did shorter rides, in the park. But, quite honestly, like, it's just such a thrill to be able to get onto a bicycle in a place like New York City, which is so chaotic and loud. And I think that's why so many people are passionate about the sport. Is it, so like anywhere, it gives you this degree of personal tranquility, which I have not felt replicated in any other athletic experience. And I do a lot of different things. There's nothing like riding a bike. It really isn't. It's like if you take it out of your life for a brief period of time and you get back on it, it's just like, a faucet of water. You're just like, now I remember why I did this. It's just a wonderful thing.
I think everybody will relate to that emotion. What about New York City? I'm originally from LA, and there were times when I felt terrified riding in LA. And I think a lot of people, when they think of New York, they think of taxi cabs and traffic and honking, and they think, oh my goodness, I'm not going to get on my bike. And then, of course, we read these stories about different issues where, as you said, it's political now, where the police are cracking down on cyclists and cyclists are upset. What is it really like riding in New York City? Is it safe? Is it a good place to ride, or would you say?
Gotten a lot better.
Has it?
Gotten a lot better. I think so. It's definitely a work in progress. Some things have gotten worse. They've changed traffic patterns. Some of the bike paths aren't especially great, but a lot of them are great. And what it's done is it encouraged more and more people to get out on their bikes. And so you see more bikes than ever. And we all know that, there's quite a tradition of cyclist anarchy in terms of, paying attention to red lights and stop signs. But, as you see cycling becoming normalized in New York City as both lifestyle and commuting behavior, you're seeing more adherence to the rules, which, I've never seen today, when you go to a stoplight at 14th Street and see, 8 or 9 cyclists stopped at a red light. It just was not something that was kind of part of the equation a decade or so ago. And that's been a pretty great thing to see. And what you've also seen, like a great many other subjects, you have a sitting mayor and Michael Bloomberg with a Department of Transportation Commissioner, Jeanette Sitikon, who you know, have power and are not afraid to wield it and are being very aggressive in terms of the implementation of these bike paths and safe street strategies and traffic calming strategies. And in addition to that, now, you know, we'll have a bike sharing program implemented in New York City, you know, certainly, hopefully before the summertime.
I was going to say eventually, right? It keeps getting delayed.
It was supposed to happen last year. It got delayed. I don't know exactly what the latest thing, but I think
Sandy was the latest delay.
You know, and the political aspect, of course, is that, you know, you have people who are, you know, not thrilled about the idea of losing parking space or competing with bikes on the roadways. And but I in degrees, I think it's a phantom political issue because the polling consistently shows, and this isn't polling that's just done by cycling agencies, these are other kinds of polls, and it's running about 60-65% in favor of these things, which, you know, that's a pretty enviable positivity scale for anything.
And so
this is a political year for a mayoral race. You're going to have candidates talking about this issue, but you know, I think this is a topic that I think New York has made its decision. It's going to become a more livable, more bike-friendly, more commuter-friendly city. You know, I don't see it going back the other way. I really don't.
Well, and hopefully that will make its way all across the country. You know, they always say, you know, what happens on the coast tends to end up in the middle of the country eventually. So that's
for sure. And you know, it has started to happen in other places. You know, I think Washington D.C. of course, you know, has its bike share program. We were in Miami Beach over the holidays and rode the bikes down there a great deal. You know, these things, you know, have improvement effects, quality of life impact upon people who have nothing to do with cycling, who do not ride bikes themselves. You know, I'm evangelical about this. I do feel like this is a kind of thing that improves communities and is not as hotly contested as sometimes it's portrayed in the press.
Yeah, good point. Well, listen, Jason, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the Fredcast. And again, on behalf of all the other cyclists who read your stuff all the time in the journal, thank you for, to use the word you just used, the evangelism that you're bringing to the paper and for spreading the word of cycling to among people who maybe otherwise wouldn't know about it. So it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for coming on the show and just keep up the great work at the journal.
Hey, thank you so much for having me anytime. I really appreciate it.
So there you go. Mainstream media comes to endemic media. It was great having Jason on. Really enjoyed it. Hope that you did as well. And not to add to the pressure or anything, but I've now invited Jason to join us on the panel on The Spokesman anytime that his schedule will allow. And so hopefully we'll be able to get him on with our typical crew on The Spokesman. It would be great to have him on to give his perspective as we talk about cycling on that show. Well, before I close out the show, I just want to give a shout out to this show's sponsors, as always, Jensen USA. Don't forget to go to jensenusa.com/thefredcast to check out my specific picks from their huge inventory of products. I've put on there some just a wide variety of products, some of which I just think are great and some of which I just think are great deals. So go ahead and check that out, jensenusa.com/thefredcast. We thank them as always for their support. And also don't forget Epic Planet. You can go to any of the links in the show notes or here in the show, or if you're listening to the enhanced version, or just go to thefredcast.com and click the Epic Planet link, choose your digital downloads and bundles and combos and DVDs, and don't forget the special discount code FRED to get 20% off at checkout. And also, I have to mention this every single time, you know what, you guys are going to Amazon all the time and you're shopping, why not shop through thefredcast.com? You're going to pay the exact same prices, you're going to get the exact same products, but we're going to get a little credit here as well to help pay for some of the expenses here at the Fredcast. So please go ahead and do that. We really do appreciate your support. Hey, I love hearing from you around here at the Fredcast. So there's lots of ways that you can stay in touch with us here at the show. Obviously, go to our website. I've mentioned it more times than I care to count here on the show, but one more time wouldn't hurt. It's www.thefredcast.com. You know, you can send us an email at any time at thefredcast thefredcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can follow along on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/thefredcast and join the Fredcast community there. You can also follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is simply Fredcast. And a multitude of ways that you can send audio comments to the show, just to send me a message, or if you'd like something to be played here on the show, you can use our new SpeakPipe functionality at thefredcast.com. You'll see that on the right-hand side of the page. It allows you just to click a button and use your microphone right on your computer to send me a voicemail message, or you can do it the old analog way. Just dial 661-513-FRED. That's area code 661-513-3733. Or if you're so inclined, make an audio comment using your computer microphone. Send me an MP3 or a WAV or an AIFF file or whatever file format you'd like, and just send it to me via email. Once again, the email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. And if you've ever listened to the Fredcast before, you know there's just one thing left to do in this week's show, and that is to bring you our PodSafe cycling music. And this week's PodSafe cycling music was chosen specifically for the Fredcast by IndoorCyclingMusic.com, the home of the free weekly featured track and premium members content of weekly 30 and 60 cardio mixes and monthly 90-minute cardio mixes to get the world moving. Go ahead and check them out. It's what I listen to when I work out. It's www.indoorcyclingmusic.com. This week's artist is Chris Daniels and the Kings. Tonight's track is called Wildcat Master. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. We are getting into the thick of the cycling season, which means another Fredcast is right around the corner. So stick around. Thanks for listening. Thanks for staying subscribed. And thanks for telling your friends about the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. We will be back shortly with another episode, but between that show and this one, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride. Trying to find a place to
dashboard, shaking up the parking lot. Hiding from a cop car, feeling like a rock star, baby. I hope you never forgot to. We might have gotten older, we never got wiser. Love that wildcat looking right. Show me a pickup truck, maybe with a little luck, we can find some open sky. Love.